This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is Behrouz Ghamari Tabrizi, who is a professor in two departments at the University of Illinois, sociology and history. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And we're going to be talking about Islam, and particularly issues of democracy and the public role of religion. And we're going to be talking about what we can learn from Iran, what the Iran experience has been like, and what that can teach people in the U.S. and other parts of the West. How did you get interested in this topic?
Well, of course, it wasn't hard for me to be interested in this topic because I lived in Iran during the Iranian Revolution and was pretty much part of that revolution. And you know, it raised many, many unanswered questions for many people like me who were not, you know, religious. We did not participate in any religious rituals, and we always had issues with the public and political role of religion. And there we were, and dealing with one of the most important revolutions of 20th century, which was very much inspired by religious doctrines, religious rituals, and a religious sense of justice, I'd say. And when I came here and I went to graduate school, and that was my burning question to get a better sense and better understanding of what kind of role religion, and in that case, in the Iranian Revolution, Islam, and in more generally around the world, religion can play in public life, and what happens to religion in the sense when it steps out of the private sphere of life and enters this public and political sphere. And of course, we all always very much concerned about whenever religion is trying to make a stand on public issues, and we fear issues of theocracy and intolerance and topics like that. So I was quite interested to get deeper into that issue and develop a better understanding of how actually in practice Islam played that role in the Iranian Revolution, and more importantly in the development of the post-revolutionary regime.
Now, where were you in Iran at the beginning of the revolution, and how old were you at that time?
I was 18 years old, okay. And already second year in college. And this is not the typical 18-year-old experience you might imagine, but
you were in Tehran.
I was in Tehran, and I was a student at a polytechnic university in Tehran, studying engineering, of course, and like many other Iranian students who are accepted to university, they start with engineering and then they go on with
some more important
issues in life.
Now, did you come from a religious family?
Not particularly. Iran is not particularly what you might call a religious society in that sense. The images that often people get from Iran that is often comparable to societies like Saudi Arabia or more religious type of societies. That is not quite my experience of growing up in Iran, and it's truly not the experience of a lot of other people.
What kind of percentages might there be? Are there studies of that in Iran in terms of what percentage of people are intensely religious, fundamentalists in terms of their commitment to Islam, and how many people are more secular?
Well, I mean, I think Iranian society is very much like American society in a sense, that the way people identify with religion in so many different ways is similar. And I wouldn't call that type of identification with religion as fundamentalism, because fundamentalism is a very, very particular way of understanding religion. But that kind of religious identification or practices is quite common, and often people try to make a sense of their religious experiences in their public lives, and exactly the same way that people do here. And there are, of course, studies in Iran. That the latest study that I am aware of that was carried out 6 or 7 years ago, and to this basic question of whether or not they consider themselves religious, or yes, they believe that their faith has something to do with the way they conduct their lives. Somewhere around 75 to 80% of people responded positively to that question. And you know, around the same percentage is true for American society.
Yes.
And so.
How do you think the misconception in America and other places in the West about Iran in terms of its religious character? I guess I'm curious as to why this kind of information hasn't affected the way people think.
Well, one important point, of course, is that Iran has an Islamic republic, and
yes,
Of course, that plays a role in it, in the way people outside Iran understand Iranian society and the way they identify Iranian society with the type of government that exists there.
But some people would say that America right now, with the Bush administration, has a Christian republic.
Of course, but I think part of the reason actually, I do the kind of work I do is exactly on that point, to try to deconstruct, in a way, this kind of relationship between the state and society and people, individuals, and also to understand that, you know, from the outside, when you look at these states, for example, the Iranian government, it's an Islamic republic, and you understand this regime as a theocratic regime, and then actually when you go and try to peel off these different layers of this regime, you understand, you realize that actually at the moment that they try to define themselves as an Islamic regime, then there are all these different ways that different groups, different factions in power try to contest what counts as Islamic. And by no means Iranian regime is a very monolithic regime, exactly because of that reason that somehow they decided to found a new governing on the basis of religion. But by doing so, inadvertently, they turned religion into a form of knowledge that can be contested in so many different layers of public discourse. And in a sense, I think this is the most important consequence, albeit unintended consequence, of Iranian revolution or the establishment of an Islamic republic, that religion or Islam became the subject of very, very heated debate uh-huh. in Iranian society. And we see a kind of understandings or hermeneutics of religion in Iran, which is completely unprecedented in any Islamic society. And the kind of transformations that are happening from within the religious establishment in Iran, which in a sense is making Islam pretty secular. But that's very counterintuitive, and one needs to really get into the nitty gritty of how different policies and government programs are carried out, and what kind of debates goes into these policies, in order to understand that how actually the idea of public religion is working in Iran. And in a sense, again, I want to say something quite counterintuitive that many people might find it difficult to accept, that in a sense, it's making Islam pretty democratic. Exactly because of that reason, that they intended to use Islam as a foundation to legitimize their policies. But again, you know, they opened up the door for many other possible interpretations of religion, of Islam, in order to, you know, use that as the justification of specific policies that they intended to implement.
Give us an example of ways in which Islam is, as it's practiced currently in Iran, is democratic.
I give you a simple example. For example, many people, for example, believed that because since the Islamic Sharia or the religious laws prohibits the prohibits music, and music is not permissible, listening to it, producing it in any form and shape.
But in Persian culture, for
well, of course,
for
you know,
millennia,
for centuries, for
so
millennia,
important.
So very important.
Yeah.
And not only culturally it was important for Iranians to listen to music, but also soon after the revolution, the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini, realized that actually music can be used as a very useful and effective propaganda tool as well. And he issued an edict and saying that actually really, music is permissible. And then, you know, he initiated and created a very fierce debate among many sources of emulation in Shiite tradition about whether or not music is permissible. And, of course, Khomeini's side won because, you know, he was, after all, the leader of the revolution. Mm-hmm. So now, you know, we have a very, very important and blooming music industry in Iran, both traditional music and then, you know, Tehran Symphony Orchestra was revived and, of course, at the beginning used for recording of revolutionary songs, and the Tehran, you know, symphony chorus came back and they recorded all these songs during the Iraq-Iran war. And so this is a very simple example of how these things work. And because when a government tries to adapt to new situations and they guided their interpretation of Islamic jurisprudence based on this principle that in Islamic tradition they call it maslaha or expediency. So whatever expediencies of government allowed, they found a religious justification for it. So in a sense, again, you know, you see that how these things might work, or, you know, there are other examples. For example, in education, they invested heavily in higher education. Today, in Iran, 60% of university students are women, and that's a very, very considerable change from the time of revolution. Also, in primary education, and focused on women education and women illiteracy in Iran now is only 15%. And this is while before revolution, the women illiteracy was close to 70%.
Really?
And so we see these kind of changes. Again, that all these things I say, they're quite counterintuitive. Because people think of Islam, people think of, you know, it's very oppressive towards women, and they keep women out of public sphere, and therefore they don't have education, they don't have jobs, they're very domesticated in a sense. Again, all these things happen with proper religious justification for each of these policies that I speak of.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce our guest on Keeping the Faith this afternoon. We're talking with Professor Behrouz Ghamari Tabrizi, professor of sociology and history. His PhD is in sociology from University of California. He taught previously in Atlanta, Georgia, before coming to the University of Illinois 3 years ago. He's published widely in many important journals, such as Critical Sociology, the International Journal of Social History, Political Anthropology, many other places. His next book will be coming out next spring, published in England and in this country. It's about Islam and dissent in post-revolutionary Iran. Islam and dissent. This is a live call-in show, and I encourage listeners who have a question or a comment for our guest today to give us a call. You may ask the professor anything you like or make a statement for him to react to. Anywhere the program is heard, you may call us toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL, the call letters of the station, of course. And that includes people who are listening on the Internet. Anywhere in the continental U.S., you may call us with that 800 number. In Champaign-Urbana, to keep that 800 number free, do use a local bunch of digits. Punch in 333-9455 if you're in Champaign-Urbana. That'll get you to several local lines, 333-WILL. Well, let me follow up on some of the issues that you've raised, Baruz. When you were 18 years old and the revolution happened when you were in Tehran in your second year of university, what effect did it have on you and other students at that time? Were you part of this revolution? Was it happening around you and you tried to just keep studying? What happened to you?
Keep studying is a challenge, of course. It still is in Iran. Of course, students are quite political in Iran, and they're very much engaged in issues of public justice and that sort of topics. When we were part of the, we were pretty much part of the revolution. We were not trying to avoid it. We were trying to make it happen faster and more effectively. And of course, the universities, as I said, were one of the centers that mobilization for revolution was happening, and of course, like any other movement, students who were part of a movement, they're a very small minority, but this very effective small minority,
loud,
they're very loud, and with a lot of power to make things happen on university campuses. And of course, I was one of those loud, as you say, students, but loud for good reasons. Like any other revolution, there are so many things that are happening at the same time. Very confusing times, sure. The most important part of the post-revolution, immediately after revolution, was the struggle for power and which factions would take over, assume political power, was one of the big issues for a year or so. And then after the consolidation of power happened by the more religious factions under Khomeini's leadership, then, like all other revolutions in the world, we have the years of reign of terror, and after that, then people start try to make sense of whatever happened. Yeah. After many people exiled, executed, and imprisoned, 20 years later, then people started thinking, so what have we done, and what can we learn from all this? Yeah. Now,
you as a secular student at this mm-hmm. time, who had worked to try to get this revolution to happen, how did you feel when it became a theocracy, when it became with the religious faction.
Of course, we were quite marginalized at the time. Yeah. And
were you personally in danger?
Of course, you know, like any other person who loses a power struggle, you feel in danger. And that, of course, was a serious consideration. But again, I think that it's important to remember that a post-revolutionary situation is very contingent. I mean, people really don't enter this situation with preconceived plans, and a lot of these plans emerge during these struggles. And of course, you know, nobody experiences revolution. This is beforehand, and then you get into it, and you learn as you do. So
it's hard to practice. It's hard to practice, absolutely.
And once you practice it, it's enough for you. I mean, well, nobody wants to go through two revolutions in a lifetime. So, and that's the biggest lesson that any revolution teaches you, that you know you want to go through it only once.
Now, did you leave voluntarily? Were you forced out?
Well, I left in 85 and came here to, you know, I went to the university, studied, and
graduate school.
And
was your family in danger?
Of course. I mean, anybody who was not part of the, you know, ruling regime was in one way or another.
How did you manage to get out?
That's too complicated. We'll get to that another program. Just be devoted to that one.
All right.
But I really wanted to actually, you know, one of the issues that I do want to address is that often in this sort of this global circle of information and knowledge, often people in other parts of the world try to learn from the West, and the West always has the claim to initiate things, and then the rest of the world would follow. And I thought that as I was working on my book, actually, I realized that how many important lessons the Iranian Revolution and the post-revolutionary environment can offer to people in the U.S. And as I said, that there are a lot of similarities actually between the two societies in terms of the role of religion in public, and actually in terms of the way many people, many secular intellectuals respond to this public role of religion. In Iran, we have a very now vocal secular opposition to the Islamic Republic, and of course we have a lot of unease among many Americans to the rise of the public role of religion in American society, that of course we can feel that in so many different spheres of life, in politics, as you said, now in the White House. One can easily say this is, you know, this is a Christian White House administration that we have here,
and a certain type of Christian.
So of course. That's exactly my point. I was going to get to that point. Of course, in education, we have these ongoing issues, questions about the role of religion in public education. And again, you know, there are all these different issues in public that I thought that the Iranian experience actually can teach a lot.
Give us some examples. What are some of the lessons the West needs to learn from the Iranian experience?
I was reading actually recently the 2002 Pew Study of Religion in Public Life in the U.S. And some of these things were quite striking. I'm always very skeptical of these polls and these studies, and you always need to read them with a salt of grain and grain of salt. I'm sorry that. They're a little bit telling, of course. Like for example, the 80% of Americans believe that the influence of religion in public life is a good thing. 80% of Americans believe that. 60% believe that America's strength is based on religion. 70% consider America as a Christian nation. And that was actually a very interesting thing. But right after 9/11, 52% of Americans believe that we have too little religion in the world. One would expect to see at least a momentarily a reaction to, sure, to religion after 9/11, but still, 52% of Americans believe that we have too little religion in the world, and or 85% of Americans believe that the role of religion should increase in public life in America. Of course, when I say that 85% believe that the role of religion should be increased in public life, it doesn't mean that, you know, they all have a certain similar kind of understanding of what religion is.
Of course.
But nevertheless, they believe that religion should play a part in public life. But now, we have, on the other hand, which is the lesson that I think that the Iranian situation can teach to us here in the U.S., that one of the things that Iranian intellectuals did, rather than trying to construct a secular humanist alternative to the dominant interpretation of Islam in Iran, they actually tried to transform religion from Islam from inside.
Uh-huh.
Rather than saying that, okay, the correct political response is secular humanism, they said that actually the correct political response to the dominant Islamic regime is to challenge their interpretation of Islam. Nobody in Iran, in the Iranian context, argued that we should not allow a specific group, a single group, to monopolize the interpretation of religion and essentialize religion under their own name.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's a very, very important lesson for us here in the U.S. Because often when we speak of public religion in American context, immediately it evokes the notion of religious right. And immediately we get engaged in this idea of fundamentalism, evangelical, right, Christianity,
yes.
Uh-huh. And this and that. And I think that that's true. That's part of public religion. But again, we have another part of public religion. Either it's there or it ought to emerge with full force to actually question and challenge those particular interpretations that are often introduced to general public without any kind of specific challenges, questions, and competing ideas.
In Christianity, and I know that much better than I know Islam, of course, because that's been my study academically as well as personally, but in Christianity there's been a strong liberal or progressive movement in the U.S. and in Europe, South America, Asia.
Right.
Is there such a movement in Islam?
Oh, of course, very much so. I think, you know, one of the centers of that movement actually is in Iran, but we have that kind of movement in Turkey. We have the similar kind of movement in Indonesia, in Egypt. There definitely is a rising, very progressive movement in Muslim societies.
Who would be some of the leaders of that movement?
Well, there in Egypt, for example, there is a university professor who's now in exile in Holland, and Abu Hamid, and in Indonesia we have leaders of this very old, actually, movement in Indonesia. Even in Europe we have, like, Tariq Ramadan, who's grandson of one of the founders of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, a very sort of progressive notion of Islam is trying to come up with new ways of understanding Islam or for Muslims in Europe, and understanding that they're out of their own original societies and they live in a new society with new cultures and new sense of social relations. In Iran also we have a number of very important, significant people. I can list the names, but not quite important at this point. Are there
names for that part of the movement within Islam the Westerners might have heard of, or should hear of, or should listen for?
The person I wrote my book, I constructed my book around his ideas, is a lay theologian, philosopher by the name of Abdul Karim Surush, who is actually...
How's the last name spelled?
Soroush. And he's a British educated philosopher of science, but has written 17 or 18 books since the revolution on the issues of hermeneutics,
interpretation of
the Quran and religious texts, other religious texts, he's pretty well known in the West, and many people call him the Luther of Islam. Of course, I have my issues with that kind of conceptualization. But my problem is that anything that happens there should find a sort of equivalent point of reference in Western traditions in order to make it comprehensible to Western audiences.
Right.
But in doing so, of course, we lose a lot of nuances and differences as well. But just to tell you the significance that is attributed to his writing.
Yes, that helps.
And, of course,
we're about halfway through our program here on Keeping the Faith this Sunday afternoon. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this program. And our guest today is Professor Behrouz Ghamari Tabrizi. I want to ask you about your name in a little bit, who is originally from Iran. And after studying engineering there, came to University of California, where he got his PhD in sociology. He's particularly interested in history as well as sociology. He'll be talking at the University YMCA this Friday noon at the Friday Forum on democratic religion and religious democracies, talking about Islam and particularly Islam in Iran. That lecture is free, open to the public. Everyone is invited to attend. There's actually pretty good parking if you need to drive into campus on Friday noons. It's sort of an open secret that there are fewer and fewer classes on Fridays these years, and so that means there are fewer students on campus and more parking for those who would like to come in for the Friday Forum lecture at the University Y.
Of course, there's always the bus.
The buses are great. We have about 50 buses an hour that come down Wright Street because we're right next to the library. So anywhere in the community, if you can get to a bus, do use the MTD and come to the Y. Let's see. Also at the Y this week, coming up on Tuesday, will be a fascinating talk by Derek Winstanley, who's chief of the Illinois Water Survey. He's going to be talking, the title is Tapped Out, Can the World Water Crisis Be Seen in Our Local Water Supply Situation? That's this Tuesday, November 6th, Derek Winstanley, chief of the Illinois Water Survey. He'll be talking about the Mahomet Aquifer and its importance to this region, and using that as an example for the water crisis, really, around the world. That's Tuesday, and then Professor Ghamari Tabrizi will be Friday Forum at noon also. You can get a lunch there at the Good Y Thai, the Y Eatery, or you can bring your own lunch or simply come to the lecture.
And I wouldn't mind if you eat during my lecture.
It's fine. That's very kind of you. Coming up on Focus 580 this week is a particular program on Thursday at 10 o'clock that listeners to Keeping the Faith might want to check out. One of the MillerCom lectures this fall is Birgit Meyer, professor in the Research Center on Religion and Society at the University of Amsterdam. And Birgit Meyer will be here talking with David Inge at about 5 or 6 minutes after 10 o'clock this Thursday on African popular cinema, Pentecostalism, that particular variety of Christianity, and the powers of darkness. So that should be a good talk, so you could hear about it on the radio, and also perhaps you'd be able to go to the MillerCom lecture as well. Those are some things coming up this week here on WILL and at the University Y, which is one of the sponsors for this Keeping the Faith program each week. Well, let's get back to our topic today. We're talking about examples in Iran of a democratic religious experience and what this theocracy, which of course means a religious a group in power, means and what people in the West, particularly in the U.S., can learn from the Iranian experience. Talk a little bit about, if you will, Professor, let me give the phone numbers again. If people would like to join in and ask a question or make a comment, call in Champaign-Urbana 333-9455, and we do eagerly encourage you to call. I'm happy to ask questions, but I love having other people make their comments as well. And toll-free, if it's a long-distance call, use 1-800-222-9455. So Champaign-Urbana 333-WILL. If you're traveling, want to call in by cell phone, we'll just tell Brett Polson, our technical director, when he answers the phone that you're on a cell phone, and he'll try to get you very quickly on the air. That 800 number again, 1-800-222-9455. Well, let's talk a little bit again about what are some of the other things that people in the West can learn about the Iranian experience?
Well, of course, when we call the Iranian regime a theocracy, I think a better conception of that regime is a theodemocracy, because it's a sort of a combination of the two. And Iran, of course, has a parliament, has a president, and people participate in these elections. Although the participation is dwindling because of so many different reasons, but so far, presidential elections usually draws somewhere around 70 to 75% of the electorate.
And better than the U.S.
Much better than the U.S. I think, or also parliamentarian elections, same amount of number of people and a little bit less, but between 55 to 60% usually participate, which is quite a good number. And on top of that, we have municipal elections, local councils, that they also have a role in managing the affairs of the cities and towns around the country. And even in those, we have somewhere around 50% participation.
We have a caller waiting on line number one. Let's encourage this person to join the conversation. Yes, you're on the air.
Yes. I hope this is appropriate, but one of the differences of Islamic governments and our own here in the U.S. that I find most intriguing and repugnant is the lack of free speech, I guess. And apparently, perhaps I'm not understanding it correctly, but the whole Salman Rushdie idea of somebody publishing a book that says something disrespectful about the Prophet and being decided by some religious authorities that he should be killed is just utterly repugnant to me. And I wonder if your guest has a comment about that.
Yes, of course you're exactly right. I didn't want to draw a comparison to and suggest that we have exactly two similar systems in the two countries. That would basically be completely unfounded. And the issue of freedom of speech, of course, every society has sets certain kinds of limits on the issues of freedoms of expression. And for example, in our society here, we consider hate speech outside the boundaries of free speech. And if on this radio station I start talking in the language of hate speech, they would immediately cut me off, won't they? I'm asking our host, I guess.
I do have a button.
Yes. They do have a button, and they do push the button. Of course, you know, the difference is that they're not going to take me to jail from here, and that's a huge and significant difference. Every society sets limits to its understanding of freedom of expression, and these limits are set in a very particular cultural, historical, and political context. And I do not absolutely condone any kind of limitation of writing a novel or anything like that. But I think we do need to understand the politics behind Khomeini's edict or the death sentence on Salman Rushdie. And I always say that an interesting anecdote about that a year before Khomeini's fatwa, Salman Rushdie was honored in Iran and was given the highest literary prize for his Midnight Children. So it was quite a shock for Iranian readers of the novel to suddenly realize that the same guy who was honored for his Midnight Children was sentenced to death by the leader of the revolution. You're exactly right. I don't think this there is any kind of comparison between the two societies in that sense. But again, we are in a very interesting historical moment in this society that we realize that a lot of our own civil liberties and freedoms of expression are shrinking. The space in which we can move nowadays in American society is becoming smaller and smaller. And of course, that corresponds to the particular situation that we face ourselves in after September 11 and the way this was constructed as a time that we are going through war and war on terror and so on and so forth. But you realize that this is another thing that we are, of course, need to be conscious of. Then when societies go through these kind of moments of change, then the principles and boundaries of freedom and of expression and freedom of mobility, freedom of assembly, these things also change with those changing times. And I give you another example that, for example, when in Iran things changed and freedoms were limited and more limited, and after the revolution. On the other hand, we need to understand that in 1980, you might not know this, but in 1980, close to 75 members of Iranian parliament and members of the government were blown up by a terrorist attack. And 2 months later, Iranian president and prime minister were assassinated. And of course,
who were the terrorists in that case?
The terrorists actually were the same group that are under the American protectorate in Iraq now, and this administration is trying to use them to sort of undermine the Iranian regime. So that's another program right there. But I ask you to think about these issues because just imagine if something like that happens. God forbid. If we have a bomb that blows up the House of Representatives, and then we have an assassinated president. Can we imagine what kind of society we are going to be living in? Or that's going to be
freedoms,
pretty hard. What freedoms can we enjoy?
So, caller, did you want to follow up?
Well, yes, I do. I appreciate the point on about current liberties being reduced by our so-called war on terror. I think that's well said. I'm curious, was there a voice of a group within Iran who were against this fatwa, against Salman Rushdie, and were they able to express themselves at all?
No, not at the time, but since mid-1990s, that a group of Iranian reformists came to power, and the president before the current president, whose name was Mohammad Khatami, was a part of that movement. A number of very key members of that administration actually pressured the religious administration to take back that fatwa, and they indeed lifted that fatwa and that death threat from Salman Rushdie. And now there are these kind of renegade, marginal religious, very radical, fanatic religious figures in Iran who argue that, no, the death sentence still is valid, but as a sort of a general voice of the government, they took it back. But it came a few years later in the mid-1990s.
Anything else, caller?
Yeah, thank you for that information. I look forward to the lecture.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate the call. Just to follow up on some of the themes from the caller, it's interesting that the novelist Rushdie is still living in spite of the fatwa, whereas it seems that some of the people who were targeted for assassination by the CIA may well not be living at this point.
Well.
is it worse to have a religious leader who's on an extreme edge of a society make those kind of claims but not have the power to carry through or to have
right. have of course, you know, in Iranian context, again, we have many, many writers whose lives were threatened. They were put in jail. Their writings were banned. And again, you know, I come back to this point that of course, the significance of Salman Rushdie affair was that it had a sort of transnational reach, and and that reach was about a writer who resided in the West. Of course, you know, if Salman Rushdie was living in India, this was a different story. And, you know, the same story is true for many Iranian writers who were in jail or prosecuted and persecuted,
right.
and their writings were
right.
banned. But again, you know, that's a struggle, and that's a that's the way that people understand them, their roles in their own societies, and.
Yeah.
And try to make their voices heard in so many different ways.
Let's move to another very current issue with Iran. Can you point to, as you're talking about different democratic characteristics of the Islamic regime in Iran presently, are there any democratic evidences in the whole discussion of the expansion of nuclear energy and perhaps moving toward nuclear weapons?
Yeah. These are very hard questions you're asking.
Of course.
No, there is general agreement in Iran among Iranians that having nuclear energy is their legitimate right, and by all the evidence that we have at this moment, they are in compliance with the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and this is clearly a political issue. But Iranians are quite unified for their right to develop nuclear energy. But I do want to go back to that point that I was saying earlier that about the participation in democratic processes. And one of the issues that I wanted to bring it back to our society here is when we think of democracy, we always think of democracy as institutions that are there and make possible for people to participate in public deliberation of political issues. Of course, when the institutions are there, it doesn't mean that people are actually going to use those institutions and indeed participate in these processes. And one of the lessons that actually Iranian Revolution tells us is that the more a government connects with culturally and traditionally, culturally, with their own subjects, the easier it is for people to participate and understand that they have something at stake by participating in these political democratic processes. For example, in remote areas in Iran, one of the reasons, of course, if you live in remote areas and you're very religious and you're into your own little communities, what good reason could possibly you have to say, okay, I'm going to go vote for elections in the parliament, and that's very far-fetched from everyday lives of these people. But again, in Iran, they put a very, very concerted effort to make it almost like a religious duty for people to participate in elections. And there is good reason for these high levels of participation in electoral politics in Iran. And here it's true. I mean, people need to feel that their voice is reflected and their participation actually can change things. Otherwise, why should they participate? I mean, if we are like in presidential election here, if you have 50%, everybody is happy that 50% of people participate in elections. But of course, there are so many different reasons why people don't participate.
It's interesting that the highest level of participation seems to be in this country in the last presidential election from conservative evangelical Christians whose pastors were telling them, you should vote. This is your religious duty to vote. You have to express your ethics. Whereas the more progressive, the more liberal, or the secular folks were seemingly not nearly as committed to voting, to participating in the process.
Or even if they do, they don't make it an imperative that this is part of your responsibility as a citizen. And everybody knows that when they say the turnout is low, we know that a very sort of right-wing leaning candidates would get elected, because everybody knows low participation means that a lot of constituents of evangelical Christian right would go to the polls.
Absolutely.
Because that. But, this is what we need to do, of course, in this country, that to have a similar alternative to a forum, a context in which people can feel connected and, obliged as a good citizen to participate in these processes. We should never, ever leave this sort of political arena vacant for, Christian rights, who basically only advocate their own views, and they argue that they have a monopoly of what Christianity is all about, and others who either don't care or they're too progressive or they believe that their participation doesn't make any difference, and I think that alternative is quite missing in American politics. And
let's talk a little bit about freedom of the press issue that the last caller raised. In this country, in many ways, the press has been co-opted by a very strong government. And, for example, to get news from Iraq, from any place where our reporters aren't sort of in bed with the armed services is impossible. But on the other hand, what are the ways that people in Iran today can get news? Does the internet make that much easier? Even though there's more control of the press.
Oh, internet is quite popular in Iran. There are a lot of internet cafes in Tehran, and also the press is quite diverse in Iran. In Tehran now we have 25 daily newspapers, and when you go in front of newspaper stands in Tehran, you see all these newspapers in front of these little shops, and it's quite an interesting scene.
Can they criticize the government?
Oh, yeah, they do. They do constantly criticize. Of course, they're all loyal opposition. I mean, they can't question the, you know, legitimacy of the government.
Yes,
but they're...
They can't call for revolution.
No, of course not. I mean, but that's understood. And out of these 25, at least 6 or 7 of them are quite critical of the government. And to that extent, again, you know, we hear always that, you know, they shut this newspaper down, they shut that newspaper down. And I was talking to a friend of mine, and I said, have you heard that they shut another 4 newspapers down? I said, but that tells also another story, that there are so many newspapers that they can constantly shut down this one and that one, but still there are, you know, 25 more left.
What's the population of Tehran?
Tehran is close to 12 million.
12 million.
Yeah.
Oh.
Very, very, very crowded.
But you have 25 newspapers for 12 million folks. That's about the population of the state of Illinois. And we have, what, maybe 10?
But maybe again, in American big cities, like if you compare that to New York City.
Yeah.
And two major papers in Chicago or 2 or 3 in New York City.
We're down to our last 30 seconds. let me just thank you for being
our
guest today. And let me just say again that Professor Behrouz Ghamari Tabrizi, and we never did get to talk about your interesting hyphenated last name. Is that two parts of your family?
Yes, I mean, Tabriz is the city in Iran, so the Tabrizi means from Tabriz.
From Tabriz, okay. Professor Ghamari Tabrizi will be at the University Y this noon at Friday Forum, November 9. Giving a free lecture on the issue of democratic religion and religious democracies, using the situation of Islam in Iran as an example. He's a professor of sociology here at the University of Illinois, and also has a joint appointment in the Department of History. He's been on the campus for the last 3 years. His PhD is from the University of California. He's published widely. His next book will be out in the spring, Islam and Dissent in Post-Revolutionary Iran. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. I'm director of the University YMCA for another 7 or 8 months, and then I'm going to be retiring. So if anybody's interested in that position, do give folks at the Y a call. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith. Next week, our guests will be talking about issues of the environment.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Is there an irreconcilable conflict between Islam and the West? A clash of civilizations? I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear prominent Western and Muslim intellectuals debate the idea. Also, a Pakistani rock star who's a devout Muslim and says there's nothing in the Quran that prohibits music. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana.
Please join us
for a free gift planning seminar for couples at 7 p.m. Thursday, November 15th, here at Campbell Hall. I'm Bill Russell, gift planning advisor at the University of Illinois Foundation, and I will answer your questions and explain a variety of tax-savvy ways to make gifts to your favorite organizations, including some that can enhance your current income. To reserve a place, please phone Martha Brown at 217-244-8128.
University of Illinois researchers have a passion for their work.
The best thing about research is this moment where it clicks and it becomes crystal clear.
University Laboratory High School students spend 15 hours with U of I scientists learning about their philosophies, goals, and visions. Tune in November 10th at 5 p.m. on AM 580 WILI.